In aggression cases, one of the critical steps in working up dogs with aggression or cats is to determine how much danger is present and in the situation. And that's what we're going to look at today. We're going to look at the overall flow of the behavior consultation and address history taking and so forth, just a little bit, but mainly we're going to look at what types of information you need to gather and assess to determine how dangerous that pet is when the owner complains that they have an animal at home that might be biting or growling and so forth. All right. For the aggression case workup, the first step, as with any aggression case, is collecting historical information. To do that, I use a 3-page behavior history form, and then when the owner comes in, we discuss that information as well as more about the pet's social behavior. And as a matter of fact, if you'd like to have a copy of my history form, you can go to my website, westwoodanimalhospital.com, and go to the form section. You'll find behavior history forms. So we're going to collect information from written information and verbal information from the owner. We're going to observe the pet's behavior, how it reacts and interacts with the family as well as people outside of the family. Next step is to make a diagnosis. Why is the animal doing the behavior it's doing? And then next we're going to evaluate the danger inherent in the situation, which is what we're going to concentrate on today. And then very importantly, and this is a crucial step, is can that danger be safely managed? And that's going to vary from family to family. And there'll be some cases where we might have a dog that's mild to moderately aggressive, but it's in a family situation where we have kids and we have a lot of people coming in the house unannounced, so we really can't control the dog's interaction with other people that could be a danger. In that case, we might have to make a decision to get the pet out of the home, rehome it if that's safe, or possibly euthanize it. On the other hand, we could have a pet that is extremely dangerous, bites, and big dog that bites and does a lot of danger, a lot of damage, but it lives in a home with maybe a single adult and who understands the dog's behavior. There are little or no visitors come to the house, and this dog can safely be maintained, even though on its own it might be more dangerous than the other pet. So we've got to look at the whole environment, the pet, its temperament, and so forth to make that evaluation and determination. Next thing in the behavior workup is a prognosis. The owners need to have some idea on what practical goals they might be able to achieve. Is it a problem where there's a really good prognosis and there's a good chance we're going to completely get rid of the aggression, or maybe we can get rid of maybe 90% of it, but 10% of the situations we still have to be careful, or there's some situations where it's just going to take too much work or too much money for the family to get into it and try to change the pet's behavior. Next is a treatment plan, and then the last is a follow-up, making contact with the owner to find out how things are going and then fine-tune the initial behavior protocol. All right. When the owner comes to you with a pet that has an aggression problem, there are a number of questions that they come with, and we're going to go through these. But the first one is, why did my pet bite somebody? And to answer that question, you need to make a diagnosis. So what criteria, what variables are present in this situation to make a diagnosis of territorial aggression or possessive aggression or so forth? And it's important that the owner has some idea of the motivation for the problem, because then they can extrapolate to other situations where maybe the dog's not had any problems yet, but could be similar to other situations where they will have problems. For example, if they understand that the dog's biting not to dominate the family, because it's a fearful pet, then they can understand that not only if they try to grab its collar and punish it, it'll bite, but if it gets caught in the backseat of the car or trapped someplace, those are other situations we would anticipate the fear arousal level to go up and to expect a bite if it can't be avoided. So diagnosis is important, and these are the criteria, these are the variables that I look at to make a diagnosis. And these are a variety of functional types of aggression, territorial and protective and fear and possessive and so forth. And what do I look at in the pet to differentiate between these different types? Well, I look at the type of vocalizations, and certainly the vocalizations are going to differ between two animals, one of which is very assertive and when it's aggressive, and the other animal which is fearful when it's aggressive. It's going to have more distressed tones, higher pitched tones to its vocalization. The postures and the behaviors of the pet will help differentiate different types of aggression. I look at the temperament of the pet. You know, is it a nice, confident animal, or is it an animal that tends to be globally anxious and skittish? The signalment of the pet, intact versus neuter, can be important in regard to some types of aggression. The health of the pet. If we have a pet that has some pain-related problems, then that might push us to a diagnosis of pain-related aggression. And I look at the location in which the problem occurs, territorial aggression. Well, that's going to be pretty much location-dependent. It's going to occur in the home environment. Not as likely to see that, and not going to see. You might see other types of aggression, but not territorial aggression outside the dog's protected area. And I look at the context. You know, what's going on when this happens? You know, what are the social dynamics of the situation? I look for look at the stimulus for it. Typically, in most cases, the stimulus and the victim or the target of the aggression are the same. So, if somebody, an unfamiliar person, comes in the yard, that's a stimulus for territorial aggression. It'll also be the target for a bite or for an attack. And that's the case in most types of aggression except for redirected aggression. With redirected aggression, the trigger for the aggressive arousal and the target are different. And so a dog sees another dog outside, becomes aggressively aroused, another dog runs up and bumps into it, this dog might turn around and attack the other resident dog as redirected aggression. So let's look at a couple of problems. What about territorial and protective aggression? There are some subtle differences. Territorial aggression is going to occur in the home situation. Protective aggression, whether the family's there or not, protective aggression is only going to occur around the family member. So it could occur at home, or it might occur on a walk. So that can differentiate those two. Fear aggression, as opposed to some of the other more assertive types of aggression. With fear aggression, you're going to see some classic signs of anxiety or in submissive behaviors. Ears down, lower body posture, tail tucked, weight back, commissure's mouth retracted horizontally towards the ears, as we mentioned earlier. So we look at all these different variables and look for variations in them to place the dog in various diagnostic categories. And there are different ways of expressing aggressive behavior, right? And we looked at a lot of many different types of reasons for dogs to be aggressive, but there are even more than that. I'd say probably any one of these dogs would probably have a good reason. If they had Johnny Cochran as a lawyer, they would get off for a bite. Cats have aggression problems, too. This is from the Journal of the National Enquirer. 63-pound cat eats neighbor's dogs, and he had an alibi. He thought they were huge mice. So I don't know what the ethics are in treating a cat that eats chihuahuas, but we treat them or we breed them. I don't know. No, not really. I didn't say that. Can anything be done? And then the second question is, can anything be done to change the behavior? And that really, what we're looking at there, are there any successful treatment protocols that we can use in this situation? And so what type of things do we reach for? Well, client education or family education is really important to give them an understanding of what's going on and how to keep the pet safe. Environmental intervention can be important. Just don't let the dog come out when visitors are in. Confine the dog. Keep a muzzle on the dog when children are around. So a number of environmental things we can recommend to keep things safe. So we want to manage the pet in this environment. With territorial aggression, one of the first things I tell the owners is never allow that dog to be aggressive again at windows or fence lines. Because every time that dog goes to a window or fence line and is aggressive, what happens? The person's passing by. They keep on going. And so in the dog's mind, aggression becomes a successful strategy, and it's very readily auto-reinforced. So that's one of the first things that we'll talk about doing. So we can manage the environment, remove or modify the targets and stimuli. Modifying a target, an example of that would be with a fearful dog. Well, we can tell people to come in to act differently. Don't reach for the dog. Don't hover over the dog. Don't trap the dog. Come in and ignore the dog. Don't make any eye contact. Be quiet. Don't make major movements or loud noises or so forth. So that can prevent aggressive arousal from getting high. So those are all real simple things people do to make things safe. And then modifying the pet, of course, is the core here of turning these problems around. And behavior modification is going to be real similar to what we discussed with fear problems earlier. We're going to use counterconditioning and desensitization, which means we're going to set up some type of protocol where we can have the dog near the person, but not near enough where the dog acts aggressive, and we can associate the person's presence or activities with something that it likes. And so we'll use food to reinforce relaxed behavior in situations where it's high arousal, intense, and aggressive. And we're not going to go into details of that right now, but that's what's done. Surgery, you know, if the dog's not been neutered, let's nip those little tumors off there. Drugs, whoops, one more. Is there any chance of getting my testicles back? If it was really a doggy heaven, I think the answer would be yes, right? Okay. Drugs can be very helpful. Medication like, well, let's talk about some of these. Some of them can be helpful, some can't. Phenothiazines, ACE promazine, the only role for that in treating aggressive dogs is to immobilize the dog. Otherwise, it's not a good medication to use in general to actually change the dog's emotional state. Barbiturates like phenobarbital, same thing. They're kind of general sedatives. Benzodiazepines, there might be a role for those in fear-aggressive problems, but the other group of drugs, we're going to skip the azapirones right now, tricyclic depressants and selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Of all those groups, SSRIs like Prozac and Paxil, especially Prozac, that's a drug I use most commonly for aggression problems in dogs and cats. Wide margin of safety, takes about 2 to 4 weeks to work. The SSRIs have few side effects, and they concentrate mainly on modulating serotonin in the limbic area of the brain, and thereby evening the animal out. So instead of being reactive and concerned and acting on and being aggressive in certain situations, the animal's more like, okay, that's happening, big deal, I don't care anymore, and allows the owners to more safely intervene and start behavior modification with serious cases. And then, unfortunately, in some cases, the drug of choice is going to be euthanasia. And when you make that decision, you're going to make that decision because you've assessed significant danger in this animal, and this animal's in a household where they don't have complete control, so they can't immediately make things safe. And we're going to talk about that in detail now. Okay. So how do we assess risk of injury? How do we tell how dangerous this situation might be? Well, there are four parameters I look at. I look at predictability, and that's a major one. If you have an unpredictable animal, you don't know when it's going to go off. That certainly increases the danger in a situation. So predictability, here the visitor says, oh, what a cute little Siamese. Is he friendly? Well, there are certain things here about this situation would probably predict that, no, he's not friendly. Okay, so predictability, the potential to cause damage, aspects about the individual as far as size and strength and temperament are important. We're going to talk about all these in detail in a moment. The human element, aspects about the family, and the complexity, the whole complexity of the situation, the number of behavior problems that the owner is dealing with, and the complexity of the human environment at home and so forth. All right, so let's look at predictability first. First of all, do we have stimuli or situations that have identified, do we know what the triggers are for aggression? In most cases, the owner's there or they're observant enough to know what's triggered the aggressive behavior. But there are cases where the bites have been maybe to small children who can't describe what happened real well, and the family's not been there, and we really don't know exactly what was done, what movement was done or whatever that triggered the bite. And so if we don't know what caused the dog to bite, then you've got to assume the dog could bite in any situation, and you have to always be safe. You almost have to treat it like a wild animal where you take no chances at all. And so use confinement and muzzles and leashes and whatever's necessary so that the dog is not presented with whatever that stimulus that was that triggered the bite in the past. Secondly, do we have a consistent response to these? So we know what the stimulus is that triggers the problem, but does the animal always react the same way? And I'd rather have a dog that bit me every time. I'd rather not have a dog that bit me every time, but I'd rather have a dog that I knew it's going to be aggressive every time I touched his head rather than a dog that only does it maybe one time out of 10. Because what happens? The family tends to let their guard down. And so if it's we know what the stimulus is, but the response is inconsistent, that tends to make things more dangerous. The benignness of the stimulus is important, too. And most people would expect if you come up and step on a dog's tail, there's a good chance he's going to bite you in the ankles. But most people wouldn't understand that. Well, you just look down and lovingly look in the dog's eyes and say, I love you, dog, that dog might jump up and bite your nose. But if it's a assertive, dominant type Springer Spaniel here, he might take offense at this apparent dominant stare by somebody he views as a subordinate. And he may jump up and bite to say, hey, back off, you shouldn't be doing that, you little weenie. And so if it's a benign stimulus, such as just looking in the dog's eye or doing something somebody wouldn't expect to trigger aggression, then that makes the dog more dangerous because people are less likely to avoid those things. Are there any warning signals? You know, there's some dogs give nice long warnings, so there's a chance for the victim to get out of the way, but other dogs give no warning whatsoever. They sit there and then they bite. Next, the latency to attack, okay? It doesn't do you any good if the dog growls and bites you at the same time, or growls and bites you a second later because you have no way of getting out of there. And so that latency of the attack, the time between the initial aggressive displays, and when the dog decides to go into action, that's important too. Longer latency, it's a safer situation. Short latency, not so safe. This is from a real nice tape from Susan.
Small changes in the dog's behavior in response to what is happening around him. Not all signals are obvious.
Not all signals are obvious, yeah. So that dog didn't look like he was going to, you know, just bing. All of a sudden he was on. That's from a really nice tape from Suzanne Hetz and Dan Estep, who are, let's see if we get back here, who are here in the Denver area. Okay, animal care and training. Really nice tape. It is an instructional tape for interpreting and understanding behaviors of dogs, and it's they have two different editions. One is for shelter staff, and one is for veterinary staff. Okay, so really what it boils down to then is do we have pertinent historical information? So taking the time to glean as much information as possible about all the situations, as well as how the dog acts in a variety of social situations, is really important in this determination. Mr. Bean was a 3-year-old mixed breed dog, very territorial, barks a lot at everyone, doesn't like it when visitors stand up, approach a family member, or leave the room. The owner said he would go postal on you. And 12 people have been bitten so far. There have been 12 people. Yeah, right. What's the clue? There have been substantial injuries. So when I have the owner fill out this form, I have a pretty good idea what I'm dealing with when they come in, and I kind of know what to do to try to make myself safe in this. And it appeared, you know, what they described were people moving, getting up, sitting down, coming in the environment, so forth. And I was talking to them, they were sitting about maybe, 6 feet away from me in the consultation room. We got sofas and chairs set up in there, and dog was on a leash. And in the course of talking to them, I just crossed my leg, and I saw, my leg was crossed, and I glanced down to see the dog's eyes get big, and his ears went up, and I went, wah! At the end of his leash, did a flip in here. And they said, oh, yeah, it doesn't like it when people cross their legs. And so that's an example of something benign that triggers a dog that people wouldn't expect would put them in any danger. Anyway, Jumper was a Dalmatian dog, very sweet dog. Just when he came in and I visited with him during the exam, just sweet as can be, a lot of soliciting behavior, attention soliciting behavior, just really sweet. Bitten 3 young children, though. No serious injuries. There have been welts and light scratches. They're all very young children. And unfortunately, there was no adult present, and so we had very little information about exactly what the children were doing when the dog bit them. And so we didn't have much information about that. So if you don't have a lot of information about the situation, then you explore how the dog acts in a wide variety of social situations to get an idea. So maybe, I was hoping maybe the owner would say, well, he does fine except if a child has a toy in his hand, he gets nervous and runs away. Or he does fine except you touch him on one little spot by his tail, he gets really nervous and runs away or something. Then we say, well, maybe the child did that, and that made him nervous and he bit. But this dog has been around a lot of people. They don't see a lot of physical interaction with people of all ages and never seen any problems. And so the owner's question was, so we didn't have an idea why this dog bit those kids. And the owner's question was, will he do it again? And my answer was, well, if the same situation occurs again, he'll bite another child. And so she we didn't know what the situation was. She was going to have to either keep that dog completely separated from the children. And so she decided to rehome it into an adult household. So this dog wasn't real aggressive, nice friendly personality, but not safe enough to stay in that home with little children. Okay, so the next thing we look at is the potential to cause damage. And so that would include such things as the size and the strength in the animal. And certainly this guy might be more likely to nail you, but this guy is going to do a lot more damage if he does. So we certainly have to respect the size and the strength of an animal in regards to the danger it poses. Second, the intensity of focus and the level of arousal during these aggressive attacks. And if it's relatively low and you can easily interrupt it, then you can make the situation safer. You can say, Rover, stop that, and have the dog stop and come to you. On the other hand, there are some dogs that once they lock in, there's nothing that's going to get their attention. And so once that dog starts to go off, there's not a lot that the owner can do. That situation is going to be more dangerous. Next, we look at the degree of bite inhibition. And dogs bite with all degrees of force. And there's some dogs are really good about inhibiting their bites. They've bitten people 100 times, maybe, but never caused any damage. A little indentation or pressure or whatever, and that's it. On the other hand, we have some that when they bite as hard as they can, and they cause serious injuries, and they cause lacerations, and they break bones, and they tear skin off off people's bodies. So they have very poor bite inhibition. So we look at two things. We look at pressure, You know, can it control the pressure? And we look at, can it control the number of bites? And I like a dog that if it's in a situation where it's really pressure and it's appropriate, yeah, maybe it'll bite and release just enough to make whoever back off, respect its space maybe if that's necessary. But in most cases, or in cases where the dog bites more than it should, bites harder than necessary for the situation, or bites multiple times even though the victim is backing off, that makes the pet more dangerous too. So degree of bite inhibition is important. Also look at the target for the aggression. You know, the dog can do a lot more damage with infants and young children than it is if it only targets adult men. So that makes a dog more dangerous because it attacks a more vulnerable person. And the type of aggression is important too. Some types of aggression are more dangerous than others. We look at all the different types of functional aggression that we see in dogs. What do you think is the most dangerous? It's most likely to cause the most serious injury. What? Dominance? Nope. Fear? Nope. Most fearful dogs, they want to get out of there. They usually don't want to bite you a bunch of times. They just want to bite you enough for you to move away. And unless you really push them, they're not going to bite multiple times. Predatory. Yeah, very good. Because what's the goal of predatory behavior? It's to kill and ingest, right? And so predatory aggression is the most dangerous type of aggression. When I'm doing pre-adoption or pre-birth counseling to help ease the new child or infant into the family, one of the things we talk about is predatory behavior. And, you know, does the dog do a lot of predatory behavior? And what does he do when he does that? And so the owner needs to recognize the ears forward and the focus and the type of things they do when they see squirrels that they want to eat. And then I caution them to look for that when the baby comes home, because maybe we don't know. The dog's never been around babies. Just because the dog has predatory aggression to small animals doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be predatory to its children. But it's possible. So you better to assume the worst instead of the best, and you get a nasty surprise. All right. So that's the kind of behavior that I kind of caution people to look for. So the baby screams or moves its hand around and a dog locks in and stalks, then I say, lock the dog up and give me a call. So we need to talk about this. And then lastly, the willingness to pursue and make contact. And that kind of goes along with multiple bites. But most dogs will even with territorial aggression or fear, they bite enough to stop it. They don't continue to chase the person to bite. If the animal's doing that, if it goes out of its way to make contact and chases and bites, then that makes it more dangerous also. And so as you're kind of seeing here, if we have a large animal that when it bites, it bites hard and it causes danger and it's unpredictable where you never know when it's going off. Those two combinations, significant potential to cause damage and unpredictability, that really puts that dog up in the danger zone. Frenchie was a boxer, a 5-year-old neutered male. He would steal clothing now and again. He had inconsistent response to drop it. Sometimes the family could say drop it, he would. Other times he'd hang on and growl. And the situation that brought the dog in was that he attacked a 12-year-old son at home. There were multiple bites with lacerations and punctures. And the son, the dog had some article of clothing, went into the living room area, I think, and the son was going, drop it like this, and got down and was telling the dog to drop it, and the dog just went off and grabbed his arm and bit him several times, and the child got up and was starting to run out of the room. He jumped up and bit him several more times in the back. And so we got poor bite inhibition, multiple bites, pursuit in bites, big animal, unpredictable behavior. That makes it a dangerous animal. Okay. The third consideration then, unfortunately, is the human element. And so we got to factor in the family into this, for better or worse. First of all, do family members have some comprehension of the danger that's inherent in the situation? And he says, she's just being friendly. And how many times you've heard, or he's just talking, or he's, you know, things like that. So oftentimes, and you can kind of understand it because they love their pets. And just like with children, you don't really want to believe that your child or your dog could do some of the things it's doing because it's such a sweet, loving dog with you. But it's important that they realize the dire seriousness of the situation. And the other thing that's important about comprehensive danger would be not just the state of denial, but the ages and the cognitive ability of people in the family. And, do we have any people that have cognitive impairments or really young children that can't understand exactly what's going on? So that puts them in more danger. So the mental faculty of the family members is important. The ability to provide safe control, easier to do if it's a single adult household than if you got a household with young kids. And young kids and often have friends in and out, and there, or they come in and out unannounced. And busy family schedules make it difficult to provide adequate, safe supervision. The degree of physical and verbal control is important. If the owner has good physical control where they can say, Rover, stop, come, and get the dog's attention and get it back because they've done a lot of training with the dog, or they can do a sit-stay and keep the dog safe as people pass by or come in and out of the house, then that dog's going to be safer than if they have no physical control whatsoever and the dog does whatever it wants. The dependability of the family is important, and if they're medical clients, sometimes you'll have an idea about how compliant and dependable they can be. If you have a family that maybe every summer they say, gosh, my dog's got that infection again, and I've still got antibiotics left from last summer. We only gave a few, and he got better, and we stopped in spite of what you said. Then you worry about that. Or if the dog's been through two or three obedience classes with the family, but they always quit in the middle of them. They just never follow through with that or other instructions. Then you start worrying if they're going to be able to follow through with your recommendations for safe management. So family size, lifestyle, ages of family members, all these are important things about the family situation and experience with dogs. And if you have a dog-savvy family or owners, they've had many dogs, they kind of know what to expect out of dogs in a lot of situations. They're going to probably make better decisions than somebody that's a first-time dog owner that doesn't understand dog behavior, has a lot of anthropomorphic preconceptions about what dogs do and why they do it and so forth. Or cats. Most of things we're talking about refer to cats, too, in regard to assessing danger. Here's a situation. I actually didn't work this case up. I got this video from a veterinarian in Kansas. And he sent the lady made this for me, this or for him, to see what this dog was doing. And wanted to comment from the veterinarian about whether there's any danger here with this dog. And this is about a 9-month-old intact, looked like it might be in a pit bull cross, a terrier cross of some sort, a family with an infant and a toddler and another dog, another little young terrier dog. And the dog was doing some unusual behavior around the swing set and around his food. And the first part of the video, she's trying to show how the dog interacts with the kids, and then she shows the problem behavior and so forth. And I want you to take a look and let me know what you think about this, about the...
Well, Bub won't stop following me. Okay, this isn't going
to
work.
So you have to be careful. She did this video, you get a little dizzy sometimes. This is just some play fighting here. Nothing real exceptional. This is one of the behaviors that she saw that she was a little concerned about. But I want you to pay real close attention, be quiet, and listen to her. It's a baby crying in the background.
Now here's Kiefer coming up to him. Bo?
He's in a zone. He's not going to listen to her.
Bo! Kiefer, go stop him.
She's hear that? She told the son to go stop him.
Okay. Now I can't get Bo to quit. I just take it away from him.
So she takes the swing away, and the dog goes and starts
wasting
a little more energy, running around.
And growling. Kiefer, go pet Bobo. Pet him.
There he is, over by the swing set again.
Yeah. Come on, we need to show the doctor that he's nice to you.
Yeah.
Come on.
And they had no problems. The kids climbed on the dog. The dog showed no aggression to the children or the parents or anything. So she did feel somewhat safe about that. And the behavior around the swing set was probably play behavior, but certainly way beyond what I'd like to see in a dog that had little children around.
Right now, I think he knows he's being videoed.
This was the other unusual behavior. She put a bowl of dry food out there, and when the dog starts to eat, it goes into these repetitive compulsive behaviors. It circles, it does some fly biting, it'll kind of stare off like it's in a zone. There's nobody over on the other side of the fence, but it'll stare and growl. And it'll eat a little bit, and then it'll go back to this behavior again.
I'm not going nowhere. Caleb.
Whoa, here we go. So, you know, I don't know exactly what was going on with this dog. I didn't get my hands on the dog. My diagnosis on this one is that the dog's just not wired right, okay? And in spite of the fact that this dog was great with the kids, you know, all the time, you know, I said, we don't know what's causing this dog to be so really high aroused in the play behavior. I wouldn't want the child in between him and the swing. And this other behavior is bizarre enough that, you know, you suspect neurotransmitter problems or whatever, but something's not right. I wouldn't feel safe with that dog in the home. And that was my recommendation as I remove it. This is another situation. How many were you here earlier when I showed video on displacement behaviors? Did you all see those earlier? Okay, displacement behaviors are normal behaviors that occur out of context, typically in anxious or conflict situations. They're just little kind of tics or little behaviors that tell you the dog's not comfortable. And they include yawning, lip licking, scratching, licking the leg in a tense situation where grooming normally wouldn't be expected. Okay, so I want you to remember that. And the importance of knowing displacement behaviors, if you're doing behavior modification, whether it's for fear or aggression, you kind of look for behaviors that tell you the dog's not completely relaxed, because you want to completely relax when you're doing desensitization and counterconditioning. And if you start seeing a lot of yawning and lip licking, that means you're probably going a little bit too fast with your counterconditioning and desensitization. The dog's not comfortable in this situation. This dog had a food aggression problem, not with its own food. The owner could touch it and its food, no problem. But if it got a container or an item of human food, the dog became extremely aggressive. They have an infant at home. They're worried about the danger to the child. So in the video, they send the video. Initially, they want to show how well-trained the dog is, and it's extremely well-trained, as you'll see. Then they want to show how well the dog does around the child, and then they show the actual aggression. And I want you to take a look, and we're going to ask for what you think about this.
Down. On your back. On your back. Good girl. Down. Sit. Sit. Stand. Good girl. Heel. Turn. Sit. Sit. Stay. Come. Sit. Sit. Leave it.
Very attentive, well trained.
Take it. Good girl. Over there. Down. Stay.
Okay, now watch the dog and the behavior. They thought the dog did very well with this child. And so they put the dog on top of the child. And there's not been any aggression so far. The dog's done real fine with the child. No aggression to the adults except around the food. See that? Again? So the dog's tolerant of the child, but did he look comfortable? No, lots of displacement behaviors. A lot of little warning signs there that the owner wasn't picking up on. And this is the problem behavior. There's a container of food.
Brandy, get down. Get up, Brandy. Leave it. Brandy, leave it. Brandy, get down.
And the owners typically didn't respond to the dog
Brandy.
Like this all the time. They just wanted to show...
Brandy, no.
How intense the dog was with this, and they couldn't interrupt it no matter how loud they yelled.
Brandy, no! 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 Brandy, no! Brandy, no! Brandy, sit! Sit! Brandy, sit!
This is that dog that was so well trained earlier in the video.
Brandy, no! Brandy, no! No! Brandy, no! Brandy, sit. Brandy, sit.
That chills up my spine every time I see that. Okay. So anyway, a little concern about the human element in both of these cases. Okay. The last thing that we look at. Yeah, the question was, does the dog treat the woman the same? Yeah, same behavior. When it gets that, and we would assume the same behavior if the infant was around. And we rehome this dog to adult household where the danger was well described to them. Now the dog, you can work on food aggression, but the arousal level was so high with a little infant like that, they just didn't want to take the chance, and I would certainly respect that. Okay. And then this brings us to the fourth parameter, the complexity of the situation. And so as the number of types of aggression increase, that makes the danger more situation because the danger more serious because you have more situations that you have to be guarded about or where the dog could be aggressive during. The number of situations stimuli that trigger aggression are important. Again, increases the opportunity for confrontations and injuries. The number of concurrent behavior problems, that can make things more complex. So as the complexity increases, the opportunity for confrontations increase, and that makes likelihood of a bite higher. This is Stubbs. Stubbs was a cocker mix, a two-year-old neuter male, and the owners complained the dog was aggressive to visitors and passersby, often aggressive to adult family members, and recently begun biting the young child in the home. And the dog would bite the child. One of the triggers was a child would grab the collar, and the dog would bite the child. The dog had problems with fear-related aggression and territorial aggression. Those were the two underlying problems here for the displays it was showing. He also had other problems. He house soiled. He had destructive chewing. He climbed on furniture, all of which were unacceptable to family members. And the big problem was we had one family member that was very impatient, very assertive. The dog wasn't going to do that in my house. And when the dog did these behaviors there in the last line, the fellow would grab the dog by the collar and give it a good whipping. And so what we had, and then what happens now is that when other people start reaching for the collar, like the child, the dog assumes that grabbing for the collar is going to end up in pain, and then the dog starts becoming aggressive toward the child. So this is an example of a situation relatively complex, multiple types of aggression, multiple situations that trigger the problem, and that makes this a more dangerous situation than some others. All right. So in summary, the risk of injury is going to depend on variables such as predictability. Have we been able to identify the triggers for the aggressive behavior, or the type of triggers that we would expect that would cause aggression, not just some simple benign behaviors on people's part? Do we have a consistent response to these triggers and situations? Is there a warning? And if there's a warning, is it adequate? Is it adequate enough duration so that a victim can protect himself or herself, or is it warning and bite at the same time, which makes things more dangerous? We want to consider the potential to cause damage, and that involves factors about the pet, the size of the pet, the temperament of the pet, the threshold for being reactive and aggressive. It depends on the target that the pet is aggressive towards, the type of aggression. As we mentioned, predatory aggression is very, very dangerous. Also depends on things such as bite inhibition, which would be the pressure of the bite, the number of bites that are involved in an incident, if it's multiple bites, if the animal pursues and bites. So hard bites, multiple bites, pursuing, biting, that all makes a situation more dangerous. And it depends on the human element. It depends on the family members present, the dynamics, how busy they are, what their schedules are like, the ages and the cognitive ability of family members, things that impact how safely they're able to manage the animal in the home to prevent any bites while we start behavior modification. And it depends on the complexity of the situation. And that would involve the number of types of aggression, the number of different stimuli that are involved, the trigger aggression, and so forth. Okay. Any questions on assessing risk of injury and danger? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What type of liability do you have when you suggest that a pet might be rehomed? There certainly is some liability there, and if you want to avoid any liability whatsoever, then you could leave it at, this dog can't live in your home. I know that. I don't know if it can be safe in another home, but I know you can't have it in your home. Okay? And, or you can say, this dog is a danger to home. You should think about euthanasia. And certainly, any dog that's aggressive to family members, I think people need to understand that that's an option, that they don't have to live with an aggressive animal and put themselves in any danger, and that may be something that they need to exercise to make things 100% safe in the home. But if you say that maybe this dog can be rehomed, I think you certainly need to tell the people they have to have complete disclosure of everything they know about the dog's temperament and behavior and aggression. You also need to document that in your record, that this dog is, the owner has told me this about this and this and this and this about this dog. I consider this dog to be too dangerous to stay in a home. I recommend they get it out of the home. The dog may possibly be safe in another home, but I've also recommend that they should consider euthanasia in this case if they want to make absolute sure that nobody else is bitten. And the real answer to that question probably should really come from an attorney. And so that's who you, if you have an attorney friend or somebody that works through the practice, that would be the person I'd want to talk to about that. Other questions regarding danger? Yes. Speak up just a little bit.
Do you have any suggestions?
Yeah. How do you increase compliance? If it's compliance for safety, you got to paint worst case scenarios. You got to say, he hasn't done this so far, but I've seen other dogs that it started out like this, and it got a lot worse. And so you just don't want to take any chance about that. I would say, you never thought the dog would be at this stage where it's snapping at people. Well, I don't want you in, a couple months from now saying, I never thought the dog would actually bite somebody. We need to take, step in before that happens. So paint worst case scenarios, look at the progression of the problem, what's been unpredictable so far, and it could be something worse around the corner that we don't expect, but could be there. Let's not put anybody in any danger. The other thing we talk about is, not only do you not want to have a responsibility of thinking back and wishing you could have prevented that child's face from being disfigured. You don't want to live with that the rest of your life or have the child do that, but you can talk about home liability. And insurance companies write about $1 billion a year in bite insurance, and they're tough. And there are some, there are breed exclusion policies now. If you report a bite, very often they'll jerk your insurance as long as that animal stays in the home. So you can also say, I don't want to put you in a situation where we have to decide between losing your home insurance and losing your pet. So let's make things safe. Now, as far as compliance and getting things done, you have to assess, what the person's lifestyle and their commitment, things like that, and put together a plan where the owner can, where you set the owner up to succeed. And you may have set it up in several junctures and give them something easy to do they can accomplish and feel good about it, and then, go on from there rather than give them so much that they just say, I can't do all this, and throw in the towel. Another question? Yes?
Over the years, your chance of success.
Yeah. What about prognosis in situations where you believe that a lot of these problems or the dogs have been trained to be dysfunctional? What's the prognosis there?
Well, do you think that that's a true
assessment? Well, if you mean they're purposely trained to be dysfunctional, yeah. Oftentimes the owner's part of the problem. But most of the time it's not because they're bad people or they do things on purpose. It's that they've either got bad information or no information at all. And they didn't know about, and this is things that where we need to step in. They didn't know about socialization. They didn't know about the importance of early training. They didn't know about habituation handling exercises. So there are a lot of things that we need to talk to people about so that they have more functional dogs in the family and functional cats in the family. And I think that if you don't discuss these with the new puppy and kitten owners, socialization and training and habituation handling and not to punish, that I think that you're doing a big disservice to the owners if you don't tell them about vaccinations. I think they're both extremely important preventative approaches to raising an animal that's going to be safe and healthy and staying in the family. Now, as far as if the animal comes in and we've had problems, they're not raising it right, they use punishment too much, they let the dog call all the shots around the house and so forth. Yeah, if you could get the owner to understand, what they've done and what they've done was bad, but there are better ways of doing this where you'll get better results. You don't want to come down too hard on them. Then sometimes you can bring them over to your side and you can give them things to do that'll help turn that behavior around. Now, if it's a problem was the owner just didn't socialize the dog, didn't have them around anybody at all for the first year of life, sometimes social deprivation can be a really difficult hurdle to get over. And some of these dogs end up being so anxious around people that it's really difficult to change that underlying fear that motivates aggressive behavior. Everyone's different. And there are some families families, I think you mentioned this too. What about the families who don't disagree? Just like parenting, you know, that's a big issue. How do we raise a child? How do we raise a dog? Well, I'd like to teach them to sit for cookies. I ain't going to make my dog sit for cookies. You know, that dog better learn to work for me. You know, you got people butting heads. And sometimes you end up being a marriage counselor with some of these pets. But if you have problems, if you have two personalities in a family that are butting heads over how this dog should be raised, that dampens the prognosis also on those dogs. So you just do the best you can. Yes? A little bit louder. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to keep the dog in the house. I said, there are things we can do. The first thing we have to do is make sure that dog's not comfortable around the child and it's very aggressive in certain situations. And I don't want the dog to get between, accidentally, maybe a cookie crumbs dropped on the floor. And so I just wouldn't let the two together to start out with. Not at all. And then you could do some safe desensitization and counter conditioning, use muzzles. There are things you could definitely do. And you got to ask, you know, what can you live with? Can you live with 99% or 1% chance the dog might bite, or can you not live with any chance at all, period? And they said, well, we just can't do it. We don't want to worry, and so that's their decision. I'm not going to try to talk them into keeping that dog. Yeah. Another question? Yes. Mr. Bean. Mr. Bean actually did quite better. We'd never got him to where I felt really, and the family felt really comfortable around a lot of people. A lot of that, some of the most important thing with that dog, as is in a lot of aggression cases, is talking about management. You know, 12 bites, that's unacceptable. You have some idea when he goes off. They actually had an idea of most of the situation. They just are kind of in denial, or maybe he won't do it this time, or I hope he doesn't bite that person and reaches for him, you know, when I'm walking him, you know. Maybe, hope he doesn't do it this time, because I'm too embarrassed to say he does bite. You know, how many people get into that situation? And so management was really, really, really important with that kid. So we did make some improvement. We were able to use the gentle leader. We used some, you know, obedience commands, leadership exercises, and we made some significant progress with him. I think the session is over. So thanks. I'll see you in another 10 minutes.